The record is 4:26 p.m. and the date is Wednesday, April 6, 2005. We have a quorum, members present, Representative Crawford, Lynn, Roekberg, myself, Chairman Anderson, and I do know that Representative Guttenberg is outside the hall en route, and Representative Ledoux is en route as well, so they should be here shortly, and we'll consider them attending. House Bill 180, workers' compensation, we're still going through that. We have two more sections to go, probably another hour and a half to go through that analysis. If anyone's here for workers' comp, that's been postponed. We'll bring it up next week just due to the time and the operating budget coming before us at 6:30. We have today House Bill 151, responsibility for eye care surgery, and House Bill 169, real estate licensee education. I know a lot of folks are here for that, and a few folks are here for 151. Representative Roper's bill will have second. And we'll bring up House Bill 151 first. I think that'll be quicker. I'm not sure. As a result, I'll look on the list here. We have quite a few folks for House Bill 151. And who are we going to have present that? John? Okay. We have John Bittner from my office to give the presentation, and then we'll go through the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Bittner. I'm staff to Representative Anderson. Before I go into my presentation, I'd like to outline the change that was made to House Bill 151 in the House HES Committee. On page 1, line 12, the bill formally stated that the 120 hours was the minimum amount of time that an ophthalmologist had to be available to their patient. That was changed to 48 hours. The change was made by the sponsor in response to testimony that 120 hours might be too much of a hardship on ophthalmologists. 48 hours was felt to be enough time to notice any major complications after surgery, while also being a reasonable amount of time to ask a doctor to stay in touch with their patient. House Bill 151 outlines rules and restrictions regarding the delegation of postoperative care for eye surgery patients. The provisions include in Section 1, adding a new section to AS 864. This will place limits on how and when a surgeon who performs eye surgery in this state may delegate responsibility to someone else for postoperative care of the patient. It will define the provisions of a co-management agreement, mandate that a surgeon who performs a surgery must remain physically available to the patient for 48 hours. The doctor may delegate this responsibility if they arrange for another ophthalmologist to care for this patient for the 48 hours. This section also outlines when a co-management agreement for post-operative care may be entered into. And it maintains that any fees incurred as a result of the co-management agreement must reflect fair market value. And finally, Section 1 includes a provision for disclosure of the co-management agreement to the patient so that they are aware of who will be caring for them. Sections 2 and 3 amends AS 864-370. This will require compliance with Section 1 of the bill by certain people who are exempt from licensing as physicians. Section 4 amends AS 864-380, adding a definition of knowingly, which is a term used in Sections 1 and 3 of the bill. Sections 5 and 7 amend the uncodified law of the state of Alaska and adds an effective date. These sections allow the state medical board to begin the regulations process before the rest of the bill takes effect. And Section 6 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska to apply the amendments made by this bill to eye surgery occurring on or after the effective date of Sections 1 through 4 of the bill. The intent of this bill is to provide standards of care regarding co-management agreements for postoperative care of eye surgery patients. The sponsor of this bill feels that there is a certain minimum standard of care each and every Alaskan should expect after receiving eye surgery. House Bill 151 ensures that they receive it. I would like to make it clear that this bill in no way reflects poorly on the co-management system. We are not against the collaboration of ophthalmologists and optometrists when it is in the best interests of the patient. All we're trying to do to achieve here is to set certain limits to the co-management system to ensure that the patient's needs come first. Thank you for listening to my testimony. If you have any questions at this time, we actually have in the audience Dr. Rosen, who represents the Alaska Eye Physicians and Surgeons, who will be able to answer your more technical questions.
So what I'm going to do is hold off questions from the committee. I'm going to have Eric Christensen, who's in the I believe committee room, come up with the Alaska Optometric Association first, so he can talk about his support or objections for the legislation, and then we'll get to Dr. Rosen, who's flown in as well, and then we will bounce back to several optometrists off-net, and then we will follow it up with one more for Bob to testify here, and that should be the majority of the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
How short that is. Just
yes.
Tiny.
One of these?
This is what I wanted to show.
Welcome. You know the drill. Name, affiliation for the record.
I am Eric Christensen. I'm a doctor of optometry from Ketchikan. I'm here representing the Alaska Optometric Association. And I just finished two terms on the board of examiners in optometry. My current term ran out in March. We, as optometrists, are opposed to this legislation. And you received a packet from the from Mr. Keto's office and from the Alaska Optometric Association that had a bunch of different things in it. But because I helped craft it last time this bill came up, it was in the last legislative session, and it was a very similar bill except for the change to 48 hours. But I helped to craft these particular statements, and so there is no precedent for this bill. Legislation of this nature does not exist in any other state. Optometrists in Alaska are state licensed to examine, diagnose, and treat conditions of the human eyes, employing methods they are educationally qualified to use as established by the Optometry Board. Co-management of pre- and post-surgical care is already highly regulated under federal law. House Bill 151 would reduce patient access to care, limit freedom of choice, and increase costs, especially for rural patients. There is no public health justification for this bill. As an optometrist, I've been in the state since 1986. I spent 1 year in Eagle River, I spent 3 years in Barrow, and I spent the rest of my time in Ketchikan. This bill doesn't directly affect me because I happen to be one of those people where pretty much we do not have an ophthalmologist who is in Ketchikan all the time. So I am not covered basically by this bill because of the hardship issue and the travel issue. Almost all of my patients pretty much have to travel to get surgery. The persons who are covered by this are all of the urban optometrists. They are no different than me. They are doctors. They had education very similar to a dentist, very similar to a family practice doctor. In my office, on a daily basis, I see people between 80 and 2. I see everybody to see what's up with their eyes. The physicians who are in my community, and one of the big changes I've noticed is that as time has gone on, physician education, we're talking about regular medical practitioners, their education in eye disease has gotten less and less, and I see almost every red eye in town now. It's almost funny because I see everything that's red comes to me. So the reasons that we are against this particular legislation is that you're legislating clinical decision making. When I refer a patient to a surgeon, I choose that surgeon based on clinical skill and his judgment in when to release the patient to me to follow them up is what I follow. If something happens to the patient, when you live especially in a small town, or you are the family optometrist, even if you're in an Anchorage, you're living in neighborhoods and so you're seeing people over and over again from those particular neighborhoods, you live with those people, you see them in the store, you coach their kids in baseball. I mean, something goes wrong, and you can't face the people. If we were doing things that were out of our scope, and there was a epidemiological evidence to support that, then yes, let's address it. But I don't see the epidemiological evidence. I say, where's the beef? I just don't see it. So that's what I have to say. Anybody questions?
Are there any questions? Yes. We're able to do.
Yes, you mentioned that you aren't covered by it because you're in Ketchikan and there is no ophthalmologist in Ketchikan, and you're about the third person today who's told me that there is an exemption for people who are in areas in which there is no ophthalmologist, and I'm missing something. I'm missing where this may be in the bill.
Well, let's look at it.
Page 2, 1A, is that it?
112. Actually, be is an ophthalmologist, and two, it'd be on page two, line under B, actually A, where was I? Is exempt from the requirements of the distance. Oh, the agreement may be entered only into when, in order to satisfy the requirements of the section, a co-management agreement for post-operative care of a patient
line
may
10.
Be. Is it line 10?
It starts at line 10, and then it goes to the, this is Chairman Anderson, it starts in the hardship, and it states if there's a hardship for line 13, the agreement may be entered only when the distance the patient would have to travel isn't an undue hardship. So.
Right, but it doesn't list an optometrist there.
Right, because it looks to me like on section C, you can only have a co-management agreement with a person who is an ophthalmologist. So I guess the way I would read D is, okay, if there's going to be a requirement to travel, which is unreasonable, it could be referred to another ophthalmologist. It still couldn't be referred to an optometrist. At least that's kind of the way I'm reading it right now. So I wanted somebody to show me where I might be reading it wrong.
Right. And when you go through and break this particular piece of legislation down, it really is poorly written. I mean, there are many areas where you can attack this from many different angles, and it just, if you look at it, but the bottom line is, for me, having been on the board and thinking about the public health of the patient, I don't believe that this serves the public health of the patient, and it really calls into question the ability of optometrists to do something they've been doing for 25 years with no evidence.
So you're saying that with or without a rural exemption, that you just think that this is a bad bill?
Yeah, it's a bad bill, right? Because it treats what's it say? It's treating persons who are in the city different from out in the rural areas. I mean, it's anti-patient. It is special interest, and I apologize for me and my brother ophthalmologist, right? No ill feelings, but you know, this particular bill really sets the hackles up on some people, but you know, you have to go through these things and discuss them for the better of the public. But I don't see any evidence, and you were provided with some studies that show that optometric co-management of surgical patients has good outcomes, very similar outcomes to those patients managed by their own surgeon.
I appreciate the Representative Ledoux's analysis here. Dr. Christman, could you tell the committee, through the chair, what the differential of the requirement for the 48 hours of post-operative care, the differential between cost to the patient, do you think, between an ophthalmologist and an optometrist would be?
Well, the differential of the cost is generally, most of the particular surgeries that are discussed and most commonly occur, okay, are really usually covered by Medicare. And it's already laid out in Medicare that you can only charge, an optometrist is allowed to charge 20% of the surgical fee. The ophthalmologist would have to reduce their fee by 20% to allow us to be paid, because most of the time the persons who are covered for cataract surgery, which is a very common eye surgery that occurs very frequently, that's covered by insurance, is covered by Medicare, because most people are over 65 that have cataract surgery. So did that answer your question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, Dr. Richard, well, my wife had cataract surgery this summer. She's not on Medicare. So, I mean, people pay real bills, and people don't
have to pay these costs.
So one of the goals of this committee for a long time is to try to lower insurance and medical service costs to providers. So, you know, all things being, is there a way you can make a distinction between what the cost of care differential would be?
I can't answer that without... I don't know what ophthalmologists charge for that. I know what my office charges for that, and probably in many cases it would be less. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lynn, I'm sorry, Lynn Guttenberg. Bob.
Yes, thank you. You may not be the one to answer this, but how many outside ophthalmologists currently do cataract surgery in Alaska? anywhere in Alaska.
How many outside?
Ophthalmologists who live outside and come into Alaska specifically to do cataract surgery.
I think there's really only two, and they're members of one group.
Two members of one group. And how many ophthalmologists do cataract surgery who are Alaska residents?
We, Representative, we can ask that, okay, that just because he might be able to answer that better. Dr. Rosen. That's okay. Okay, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you.
No, you.
Okay, thank you. In the 48 hours after the surgery, if the procedure needs a follow-up, then I've got the definitions of the optometrist and ophthalmologist here. And when it says one of the things optometry does not allow is lasers, x-ray, surgery, or pharmaceutical agents, if in that 48 hours one of those things is required or something outside your practice, what happens then?
Then you work with the network of care providers that you work with. If I say it was me in Ketchikan, right, I would call up the emergency room doctor, right, and I'd tell him what I have, and I'd say, hey, we need to do, and I would call the surgeon who did the cataract surgery, right, and I would talk to them and say, here's what we've got, here's what we need to do, we need to get this, either we can manage it now, or we need to send the person down, get them started on a certain medications now, because I can't start, you know, IV medications, right, but because I've developed a relationship in my community, right, with my physicians and the emergency room, that's what we would do there. If it was in Anchorage, right, if it was in Anchorage, then that optometrist would, if he had referred the patient to, let's say, this ophthalmologist who was in question, who maybe he left, right, he would be in consult with that ophthalmologist and the optometrist who is always at the facility that the ophthalmologist has. And this optometrist is residency trained in postoperative care of patients. Postoperative, that's his focus. He focuses on that. And that particular optometrist, Paul Barney, has seen, I asked him the other day, he's seen upwards, since he graduated from optometry school, upwards of 30,000 one day after surgical care visits with patients. I would almost say that he's seen more patients than many ophthalmologists see for surgery and for cataract surgery.
So how many times a year, or what percentage of times that you're doing this care after surgery care, do you have to go back to the ophthalmologist or refer to somebody else? Refer to them
with that particular. Yeah. It really depends upon the surgery, but very rarely, right? Usually, for me, the things that are going to be where there's going to be kind of continual discussion and patient coming back and forth and things like that are more technical eye surgeries, like surgeries due to retinal detachments or glaucoma surgeries or those more intense surgeries. The surgeries that the ophthalmologist in question in this particular that's affected by this bill is doing is cataract surgery and refractive surgery, which are, although technical in nature, not as involved systemically.
Thank you. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Chris, you mentioned in your earlier testimony that this wouldn't affect you. Is that in part because there is not an ophthalmologist in your community?
Yeah, or that's the way we'd...
the bill itself, but as a practical matter.
Right, but as a practical matter. Right, right.
So that really drives a lot of this, because the issue here is what I believe, whether or not clinicians or ophthalmologists can come in, would be able to enter a community, perform the surgeries, and then have the postoperative co-management done by an optometrist. And that is really the crux of the matter. Is that correct?
Right. The crux of the matter is that the concern was is that with a particular ophthalmologist and that person was leaving the patient in the care of a non-ophthalmologist, an optometrist, doctor of optometry, less than, it used to be 5 days, but now it's been dropped down to 48 hours is what it is. But the whole thing that we're opposed to is, why do we need to regulate this? I mean, why do we need to regulate this? There's no epidemiological basis for it. There's not, I was on the board, in 8 years, we never had one discussion with the medical board about problems due to patients due to poor care.
So, Mr. Chairman, I mean, your testimony then would be this is not a issue of quality of care for the patient. It's based on more or less economic arguments.
It's based on more economic arguments, I would guess.
Or the cost of care arguments.
Cost of care arguments, right. There's a feeling within optometry and, optometry and ophthalmology, we get along and then we don't. But a feeling that this is a part of a bigger picture. One, it doesn't allow us to be able to focus on for optometrists to be able to focus on the bill that we would really like to focus on, which is our amplification bill. Two, this has been tried several times in other states, 4 times that I know of, nationally to get a co-management bill, a bill limiting co-management for optometrists so that they can start taking away care. If you can, in my mind, and if you... Last year, and I was able to go back to Washington, D.C., the veterans, I don't know if you heard about the veterans thing that Senator Murkowski was involved in. There was a optometrist in Oklahoma can do laser surgeries. They go through the same, they go through training to become allowed and licensed to do laser surgeries. There was an optometrist who was doing laser surgeries at a VA hospital in Oklahoma. A local ophthalmologist got word of that and made a huge stink and basically said that this particular person was doing improper care where there was no epidemiological evidence. All of her outcomes were similar to what other ophthalmologists had done. And the feeling is that the reason for that is because optometry does most of their residencies, their higher order residencies are all through the VA. Optometry does not receive funds for their residencies from the Medicare system. Ophthalmology and other medical subspecialties receive funds for the training of their residents through Medicare. Optometry does not. So the way we train, that our residents are trained, these higher order people in optometry, are through the VA system. And so if you stop that, well, then you don't have any, you can't say that you had... It stops optometry, basically. It stops us from moving forward.
Final question, Mr. Chairman.
Final question, okay. Then we'll go to Representative Guttenberg, then anyone else, and we're going to wrap
quickly,
up because I've given 25 minutes.
Right, very quickly. If you were typically an optometrist, if there was a aftercare problem, if they lived in an urban area where ophthalmologists were available, they would refer that person to an ophthalmologist, whether it was one that performed the surgery or otherwise, would they not?
Right.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg?
No, that's all right.
Anyone else has a question? No. I have a question. I'm the sponsor of the bill as the chairman of Labor and Commerce, so your opinion's your opinion, and what rubs me wrong, whether people agree with it or not, is when you say the bill's anti-patient, anti-business, particularly anti-patient. And I'm intrigued if you suggest that on the record, why Providence Hospital, the Alaska Medical Association, Dr. Troxell, speaking for himself, surgeon who is the head of the medical board, the ophthalmology associations nationally and statewide. Why would they support it?
I mean, well, they're all physicians. They're all a part of the physician group. I mean, it's all it's all about. Yeah, we can have differences of opinion, right? But and that's what it is. It's a difference. It's a difference of opinion. But show me. Show me the money. Show me the evidence. Where is the evidence that it's that optometrists are offering inferior care? We've been doing it for 25 years. You're taking something away that we have been doing for 25 years without problem.
And the other quick question, you were comparing to other states where you said, I won't quote you, but this is somewhat of an anomaly. because in other states it hasn't passed. But didn't similar legislation go through the entire legislature, if you're going to use precedent, several years ago, and ultimately the governor, Governor Knowles, vetoed it, but it went through both houses?
No, that was our amplification bill. That was to allow optometrists to use, we would be allowed to use medications for treatment of, right.
Okay, because I didn't know the history on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there any other Representative Linton?
Well, I actually had a question with the chair, if that's okay.
Sure.
In your sponsor statement, you have several places in there where you refer to what sounded like a majority to me. It says Cataract Mill characterized. Would you explain what you mean by that and how that would apply to this bill?
That's a good question. I would rather have it's referring to ophthalmologists coming to Alaska, not optometrists. But I will have Dr. Rosen speak to that.
Because you mentioned Cataract Mill in the sponsor statement.
Yep.
So that must relate to the bill somehow.
Oh, for sure it does.
And could you explain
okay.
that?
You bet. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. We'll go next to Dr. Rosen. And then standing by is Cheryl Lentfer, and then we'll have Randy Johnston, then we'll wrap up with Bob Lozier, and then we'll have a vote by the realtors if they're for the optometrists or ophthalmologists.
Okay. Who has the most houses to list?
My name is Carl Rosen. I'm an ophthalmologist. I perform oculoplastic, orbital surgery, and neuro-ophthalmology. I'm the only specialist in these areas in the state of Alaska. I am board certified and fellowship trained, and I want to thank you for allowing me the chance to speak on this important bill. Common sense would dictate that a surgeon physician, a graduate of medical school, should decide, after discussion with the patient, who should have surgery. Further, the surgeon should obtain consent for the surgery and should follow the patient after surgery. It makes sense, but the opposition would have you believe otherwise. All we are asking is once a surgeon operates on a patient, that the surgeon be available to the patient for 48 hours or have another ophthalmologist who's similarly trained take care of the patient during this time period when complications most often happen. After that, an optometrist may assume care. Let me also make it clear that rural areas are exempt, and we went through this. If it is necessary for a patient to co-manage with an optometrist, that is fine with us. If a patient or an ophthalmologist has a hardship issue because of travel or time constraints, then the arrangement can work as well. We're not saying do away with co-management. Co-management has been going on for a number of years, but it should not be reflexive or routine. That relationship that has occurred because of a financial relationship that has been developed by some of these cataract mills. What we are trying to do is prevent further itinerant surgeons, and there are rumors flying around that more are coming because the business model that has been created works so effectively. The Office of the Inspector General and Medicare never intended co-management to be done routinely, and that is important. It's critical. It was to be done on a case-per-case basis where the patient understood what they were getting into, and it's all about the patient. They understood what they were getting into, and it only occurred when the surgeon couldn't be around. Now, to make a business model where I don't decide who gets surgery, I just show up for surgery, I hit and run, and then I'm gone, and then someone who does not do surgery takes care of the patient, is a problem for us. It's a problem for the ophthalmologist, and it's a problem for the other medical specialties in the community. This practice is relatively new, or this business model is relatively new, and that explains why there's so much recent interest and why it's only gotten ramped up recently. What happens to a patient who has a problem? The optometrist, and I am not trying to get into any significant arguments with optometry. It's a valuable specialty, but they do not carry a beeper. This beeper can make people psychotic, and I've become so sometimes. But I carry it 24/7. I am available all the time. An optometrist does not have privileges to walk into Providence Hospital or Alaska Regional Hospital or Valley Hospital and to see the patient. And an emergency room doc will not allow that liability to occur. So what happens? An itinerant surgeon comes in, operates, does 100 cases a month, which is a phenomenal amount of cases, 1,100 a year, 8,000 so far, and then leaves. If there's a problem, and problems have occurred, so the epidemiological data is available if you dig deep enough. When that occurs, and I had one 6 months ago, 11:30 at night, My beeper goes off. The optometrist was nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found. I had to deal with the emergency room. I had to see the patient who did not, was never seen in my facility or my clinic. And I have we have the largest practice in Alaska. We have 5 ophthalmologists and 1 optometrist. We take care of probably about 50,000 patients a year. And I didn't know that person. I had to track down Dr. Ford. It was not easy. Still could not find the optometrist who was supposedly available for the post-op co-management. So that's just one example. Now, Dr. Ford also failed to describe other types of complications that have occurred. With so many surgeries, you're bound to get complications. It is true. I am not known as a cataract surgeon. I do facial reconstruction. I do tumors, cancers, plain wrecks, bare maulings. That's my thing.
And Doctor, I have to interrupt so the committee members know, because we were in Hess and it was in-depth and fairly assiduous as we went through that. You were online from Anchorage. Yet Dr. Ford is a medical doctor.
Dr. Ford is an MD.
And he has a practice in Washington, and
yes,
he testified that he and 5 other physicians fly to Alaska and perform these surgeries.
That's right.
That's what he's referring to.
And that's what I mean by itinerant surgery.
Statement in the statement.
They have never taken call in the state of Alaska. They do not have privileges at Providence or Alaska Regional Hospital to take call. They've never asked for it, although he did say that he was thinking about it. But the fact is that the people in the community who live here and work here do take call as a service that is free and part of our medical care and what we give back to the community. The only thing it does is it increases my liability, sticks my neck out, and puts more demand on my life. Now, I don't mind it. The favorite thing I do is trauma. I love trauma, and I'm good at it. But we do it as a courtesy. We don't have to take call. I could today say, no, I do not want to take call. I want to do the same thing that Dr. Ford does or any itinerant surgeon does. I don't need to walk into Providence Hospital or Alaska Regional.
And I'm going to interject again. Call means that you get called on your beeper,
that
and it
at
could
2
be
o'clock in the morning,
and you don't get compensated.
I do not get compensated. It's a free service that I offer. And many times, I never see any dime. I do it because I live in Alaska. Just one more thing that needs to be discussed. Complications do occur. They occur to the best surgeons. When you do 1,100 cases a year, you're going to have more than 3 over a 7 or 8 year period. And he failed to mention that there's been at least, as far as I know, over 15 retinal detachments last year alone, which was not talked about or discussed. And that, in my book, is a complication. In summary, this is a good bill. It will raise the standard of care for Alaskans, and I thank you for your time.
Okay, are there any questions for?
I had a question.
Okay. Representative Lynn, then Representative Dew. And by the way, my staff handed me a note. We have a conceptual amendment in the works, and I'll read it. I won't have it written to because it may not be explanatory, where we will add and just be prepared while we're asking questions on page 2, line 4, after ophthalmologist, we're going to add or optometrist. And that should quell your anxiety about communities. And I hope that Dr. Christensen looks at that too. But go ahead, Representative Lynn.
Well, I think you may have answered the question partially in what you just said, but I'll ask it again anyway to make sure. How many complaints have you had within the last year of complications resulting from cataract surgery?
You know, this is not an area that we like to delve into. Okay, we don't have a resource center or a database where we collect complications. We leave it up to the trial attorneys. what we do, though, is
there
we
will
hear,
be laughter for the record.
We hear about things, and again, I'm not a cataract type of guy. I do cataract surgery. I'm a very competent surgeon. But you hear about things in the community. We don't track down these people, but for testimony today, I did a little digging, and I came up with those numbers or with those incidents. So I don't know exactly how many, but it's more than was talked about at the last testimony.
So basically, they're just anecdotal. How many?
Well, it's more than anecdotal. I could go into it a little bit more, but I don't know if it's appropriate.
Well, and another thing, too, Is this bill aimed at one outside practitioner or
a
group of people?
You could think it was that way, but we don't want further itinerant surgeons to pick Alaska as the final frontier where this type of business model works. We carry enough burden on our backs. We don't want to enhance that or magnify that in any way.
Because I know, sir, and if I may, in the sponsor statement, several places it refers to cataract mill. Would you refer to any physician currently operating in Alaska as operating a cataract mill, quote unquote?
Yes.
Could you define what a cataract mill is?
Cataract mill, I think, is defined by itself. You know, if he's testified that 100 cases for 3 days worth of work, and you don't see your patient before or after surgery, I would classify that as a cataract mill.
Okay, and one final question. I've heard you mention one particular doctor's name two or three times. Is this, how many outside ophthalmologists are doing this, quote, cataract mill operation?
Well, there's five that we know of. Again, we don't have a database on all the areas in Alaska. There may be things going on in Nome and Bethel that we don't hear about. Sitka, apparently there's someone from Portland that comes up. It's just not something that we have enough to do.
So there are, if I may, there are ophthalmologists who fly into Nome to do cataract surgery?
No. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Rookberg, and then we'll move on here.
No.
Oh, let's let someone else out. Just a couple quick questions so we can kind of be in coincide with the Hess Committee questions. So just briefly on the call, what your point is that physicians, not optometrists, have to have call, and itinerant or out-of-state ophthalmologists that come in for surgery, you're not judging on their ability to practice. You're saying they're not staying around to be on call, and that's one aspect that's frustrating for surgeons in the state.
Right. We've said enough is enough. We feel abused by this issue. We've invited them to take call, and they've rebuffed us. And, you know, we would welcome any outside help if they want to come up here and do surgery. But you're right. They have not taken call.
And then the second question is, we amended in the Hess Committee that it's required that an ophthalmologist, in this case, that flies to Alaska that performs surgery, at minimum must stay 2 days, 48 hours after that surgery for post-operative care, not in a slight of the optometrist, but so there is a surgeon on call, I won't use the word on call, but in accessibility. And there was a statement in the Hess Committee that the gentleman said he could still fly in his jet fairly fast. And your response is you would prefer someone to be there. That's
We compromised on that because we thought that we could get this enacted, primarily because, look, I have nothing against optometry. In reality, I think it's a wonderful specialty, but for those two most critical days, I would rather have that surgeon take care of his patient than me or one of my colleagues who has never met the patient, who doesn't know what type of surgery was done, and to kind of resurrect the entire story during a critical period can be very dangerous.
And then last question, two more questions in just with the response. American Academy of Ophthalmology sent in correspondence. I think all the legislators have that on the committee. And they stated that common surgical complications in the immediate post-operative period, 48 hours after eye surgery, can be, and they gave a list. You obviously concur with that problems can occur. Maybe in the minority, but they can occur.
They do occur. And let me just say that when they do occur, it's bad.
Okay. And then the last question I have is with regard, and it was a question asked, and I'm just trying to duplicate because some of the committee members may not have the experience that some of the Hess committee members had, nurse and others. The workers' or medical malpractice coverage, I mean, I don't want to get into a debate of is an optometrist as qualified as a surgeon, but there is a difference. First of all, part A of the question, there is a difference in the years you go to school. We're talking different areas of practice. And is that correct?
That is correct.
And then secondly, I would assume your medical malpractice is a lot more.
I don't know.
And
I don't know.
I haven't researched that enough.
I don't know.
Just for a disparity.
There's one other thing I should add. A major journal, it's called Ophthalmology, which is one of our major journals, did publish in a peer-reviewed journal that co-management increases malpractice for refractive surgery. That is published and is available for anyone to review.
Okay. Are there any other questions, Representative Roper?
Yeah, very briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Rosen, first I'd like to
thank you for your practice of medicine up here and your devotion to your patients and being on call and so forth. But you indicated in your practice you have five ophthalmologists and one optometrist. Does the optometrist that you have on your staff, do they do post-operative care?
I don't know exactly what he does. He certainly relies on us for any problems that come up. And we speak, he's across the hall. We speak really all the time, basically, if there's a problem patient. I see patients for him almost on a daily basis if he needs me to. And we're all available for him.
But you're not certain whether he does post-operative care, though.
You know, I don't know.
Okay, final question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Dr. Rosen, you said that in your testimony that there was epidemiological data available, but then after further questioning, you said there was you don't have a database or no data, which I think we understand partially why, but I mean, that's kind of contradictory.
Okay.
Can you explain yourself a little bit?
Yeah, I will explain myself. The American Academy of Ophthalmology has realized how controversial and this issue is. So they've, at the last meeting, which was held in New Orleans in end of October of 2004, they've created a database, and they're collecting this information. I don't have it at my fingertips, but it is coming out, number one. Number two, I've discussed with my peers information about complications, and it's certainly greater than what has been discussed by others. So I can't put that together and publish that in a peer-reviewed literature, but it's certainly more than what was brought up in prior testimony. And that needs to be understood by the committee. So things do happen to patients when you operate a lot. Regardless of how good a surgeon you are, you're going to wind up with problems. And we want to stem the delay of care that may occur because of that.
Okay, now would you please start Guess Who's These Eyes? Just kidding. Come on, people. Sorry. Stay with me. Okay. if you want to crank the door, Josh, I know it's getting hot in here. Okay, what we're going to do, and I'm going to ask Dr. Rosen and Dr. Christensen are here to stand by. I don't want to go much farther because we have another bill. I think we're coming to close in terms of testimony without being duplicative. I'm going to go to Cheryl Lentfer and I'm going to go to Randy Johnston. I assume they're both optometrists. The other folks, Bob and Michael, yeah, at some point we're going to be duplicating everything. So, and they've said they're just there to answer questions, I presume, in Anchorage. So Cheryl and Randy, if you could keep your testimony down to a couple minutes each out of fairness here, and then we will go to Bob in the audience here, Lozier, and then unless there's someone with something new or pressing, we will close public testimony on this bill. And then I think there's an amendment that might resolve the concerns by Representative Ledoux. So, Cheryl Lentfer. Are you online, Cheryl?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yep. And did you hear my requirements here, if that's okay for time?
I did.
Perfect.
I did.
Thank you.
And I'm going to start my testimony a little bit different. I'm just going to respond with straight statements based upon some questions you guys asked and then go right into my testimony. I'm a practicing optometrist in Anchorage in Wasilla for almost 10 years now. And I'm also involved with our association up here as well. And I, of course, want to recommend that you oppose House Bill 151. Some quick statements that were brought up in just the last discussion. There was a statement said that we don't take call, and it's true, we don't take call at the hospital, but if we are VSP members, we do have to carry a beeper around with us. So we do take call. That was a statement that was misunderstood. Additionally, the bill deals with mostly co-management. It does not deal with Dr. Ford, the surgeon that Dr. Rosen keeps referring to throughout this. So let's not lose perspective of what this bill really is. Also, with the surgery, especially cataract surgery that everyone's addressing, cataract surgery, the most complications afterward are usually referred to a separate ophthalmologist anyway. It's usually a retinal issue that happens. The ophthalmologist, whether it's local or out of state, usually can't address that problem and is usually sent onto a specialist. Also, an optometrist or another eye care professional cannot co-manage unless there's a contract. That's what this bill says. Also, Dr. Rosen implied there's a financial relationship between optometrists and these outside eye doctors, and there's no such thing. There's no extra gain, don't get paid any different, nothing like that. And then on to my testimony, I will make it direct and quick. I want to cover four issues. I want to cover the co-management aspect, the availability of eye health care professionals, the financial aspect, us being qualified, and the restriction of outside surgeons, and as well as asking legislation to start regulating medicine. For 20 years in Alaska, optometrists have been co-managing eye surgery for the benefit of Alaskans. There's been over 100 optometrists in Alaska, and they range from Nome to Southeast. After 4 years of doctorate work, inclusive of the whole human body and ocular system, both in the classroom and in clinic, we're well qualified to treat the ocular system as well as co-manage. This bill would allow under hardship, and you guys talked about this in different capacities, people not qualified to co-manage. Optometrists would not be able to co-manage within this time period. If an optometrist does intervene, in this bill it does say that it would be a Class A misdemeanor. This is difficult to understand how this would benefit Alaskans. This leads to a second issue of availability. Optometrist availability is remarkable in the state of Alaska. We're located statewide and are commonly the only eye care professionals within hours. There are only 26 eye surgeons in the state, and they are located in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Soldotna, Homer, Wasilla, and Juneau. It would be tragic if an optometrist received a phone call in the middle of the night, no surgeon was available, and the care had to be denied secondary to it, a risk of it being a misdemeanor. In previous testimony in the bill, it suggested that co-management was a financial interest for optometrists. Since the majority of the testimony was relating to cataract surgery, this isn't a very valid point. Majority of cataract surgery patients are Medicare, and there's not too many aspects of medicine that are paid well by Medicare. Also, in previous discussion about the bill, optometrists were referred to as not qualified and provide lesser care. I mentioned optometrists' four-year doctorate program covering the whole human body and the ocular system. In addition, for a living, we examine the ocular system, diagnose, manage, and treat eye disease every working day. Put in more tangible text, the National Institute of Health issued a study establishing the optometrists provide excellent co-management eye care. And this study was done by medical doctors. And this is federal for the National Institute of Health as a federal organization. And lastly, the bill restricts outside surgeons and therefore competition, and it asks legislators to start regulating medicine. With medicine constantly evolving, surgeries are evolving, and the critical period for follow-up may barely exist in the future. This is creating eye care professionals to return to the legislators to change the law again. Typically, the medical board regulates its body and not the legislative body. Co-management, again, is already federally regulated. Co-management has been part of our profession for well before I started practicing. The patients being talked about in this legislation are typically our patients of the optometrist, been with us a long time, that we're referring to the eye surgeon. Optometrists are very educated and qualified to co-manage, and we're extremely available. Now, please vote no on this bill.
Thank you, Cheryl. If there are no questions, we'll go next to Randy Johnston.
Hello.
Hi, Randy. If you could keep your comments within several minutes and go ahead and testify.
I will, but I'm not an optometrist. I'm an ophthalmologist. This is Randy Johnston.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Senior Secretary for Advocacy from the American Academy of Ophthalmology. I'm also a practicing ophthalmologist in the state of Wyoming, and we understand the issues involved with patients having to travel great distances, not as great as yours, but greater than some. And I think Dr. Rosen has covered the territory very well. I would just like to respond to a couple of points. First of all, it really is a patient concern. I think you received a letter from Dr. Day, our president, detailing, some of the commonly seen within 48 hours if they occur complications after cataract surgery. Part of the problem with optometrists seeing the patient if one of these complications develops is that many of these require additional surgery. It's not something that you can take the patient to the hospital and have the emergency room doctor start an IV medicine. If it's infection inside the eye, IV medicine doesn't do any good. If it's a flat chamber with a choroidal hemorrhage, intravenous medicine isn't the solution. If it's malignant glaucoma, emergency surgery is the only way to solve the problem. There are places in Wyoming and in Alaska as well where you don't have optimal coverage, and in that case, certainly the optometrists are doing the best they can to help the patients. But in areas where there are available ophthalmologists, it really makes no sense during this critical period to have someone who's not capable of surgically intervening following the patient. The complications are fortunately uncommon, but devastating when they occur. Infection inside the eye, which is a frequently blinding condition, occurs on average 1 in every 1,000 cases. And so if you're doing 1,100 cases a year, you're likely to see at least one of those a year if it's recognized. One of the points which was made, I believe, by Dr. Christensen is that optometric follow-up is a cost saver for the patient, and that really isn't the case. A Medicare cataract fee, and most of these are cataracts, 80% of the fee is for preoperative and intraoperative care. 20% of the fee is for post-op care. In cases where a patient is followed postoperatively by the optometrist, that 20% charge is exactly the same as the ophthalmologist would charge. We're all bound by the same rules in terms of what we can charge, and so there is no cost savings because the Medicare determines the fee by percentage. And I can't speak to the Alaska itinerant surgeons or some of the other problems that you might have, but I can speak to the ones in Wyoming. In Wyoming, co-management is more often used as a tool to drive patients to the surgeon of the optometrist's choice in return for the guarantee that those patients will return for post-op care. In Cheyenne, we have four cataract surgeons in town. We're routinely bypassed by the local optometrists who send their patients 50 miles away to Greeley or Fort Collins, Colorado, because they have agreements with the doctors there that the patients will come back for post-op care. We believe it's important to follow our own patients in the immediate post-op period, and they don't seem to like that, so we don't get referrals from them. That's really all I had to say, unless there are questions.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Johnston. I'm sorry, and I didn't realize with the AAO, so Dr. Bob Palmer, medical doctor, and Dr. Michael Levitt are also online, but they're here to answer questions. I think Dr. Johnston's covered that. I don't see any questions. Thank you, Dr. Johnston. The last person I have here to testify is actually in the audience, and it's Bob Lozier. If you could clear the way for him to come up, and he'll state who he's with for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Lozier. I'm the co-chairman of the Alaska Native Brotherhood Camp No. 2 Legislative Committee. And also, I'm an Alaska Native. I've lived and worked in both rural Alaska and urban Alaska. I'm legally blind as a result of type 2 diabetes. And I've had an optometrist all my life. And a month before I became blind, I had gone and gotten new glasses. And my optometrist failed to recognize that I was beginning to have problems and advised me. But that was not his fault. It was my own health situation. But since that time, I've had 9 surgeries. I've had a lot of pre-operation diagnosis and treatment. I've had laser surgeries for macular degeneration. I've had cataract surgery. I'm totally blind in my right eye. I have a little bit of retina left in my left eye, and with the help of my ophthalmologist, and I can see a little bit. But with regard to this, I support this bill. I'm just a consumer. I'm not involved in the fees which I pay. Sounds like they're arguing over our fees as consumers, and I had insurance, and I had paid a lot of money, over $100,000, just to be able to see what little I have now. I would advise the committee that I am concerned as a citizen and an Alaska Native. Our people have a lot of complications in their health, a lot of it dealing with diabetes and other complications. And I have found that the ophthalmologists are capable of interacting with my other doctors who treat diabetes, and I'm also a kidney transplant patient. And you will find that a patient takes many, many pills and much treatment in order to deal with these kinds of complications. And I am a little concerned that an optometrist would not have the licensing or the capability to prescribe and provide drugs. For instance, I use Pred-4, and that's a steroid, and that can affect your whole body, and it's used very, very carefully by the ophthalmologist, and I'm told exactly when and how to use that and for how long and whatever. It's used in conjunction with other drugs like atropine, which can affect the heart. What I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you know, it's best to have an ophthalmologist who's trained to deal with not only your eye but your whole body and be able to communicate with other doctors that might be treating you. And I really think it's very important that however this co-management thing works, that there's a link between the surgeon and whoever else is following in post-operative care. There's got to be a real link there, and it can't be just for the sake of money. It's got to have a good relationship, and I'm a little nervous, Mr. Chairman, to hear this argument between optometrists and ophthalmologists who are working in the same profession, and I don't get a sense as a consumer that there is any cooperation, and that's very important. Just to wrap up my testimony, Mr. Chairman, I do support this legislation. I do have real-life experience with this, and there's no amount of money in terms of fees or whatever that can help you if you're blind. And the most dangerous thing about these surgeries, the cataract surgery just is one type. I've had all the other types I'm talking to you about, and they're common. There's no amount of money that can replace your eyes and your eyesight. And the risk of inflammation and other complications in your eye in post-operative care and even thereafter is very, very high with eye. And I'm a living example, and I have real life experience. And so I would hope you would take care and support this bill.
Okay, thank you, Bob. I'm looking to see if there are any questions. There are not. I appreciate your patience waiting, and the next folks for the next bill, we're getting to it soon. Okay. I don't see any questions, so I'm going to close the public hearing portion of this bill, and I'm going to offer an amendment, and I think it's going to resolve what Representative Ledoux stated. If members can turn to page 2 of the CS for House Bill 151 Hess version, obviously the bill we're working with, page 2, line 4, what I'd like to change is, you'll see it's subsection 1, and currently it states, is an ophthalmologist, and then there's requirements. And after those requirements, then there is the ability farther down, which if there is a distance problem, then there's an exemption. I'd like to make a conceptual amendment that we delete ophthalmologist, semicolon, and insert, is an optometrist, comma, or an ophthalmologist who either, and then goes through the requirements. I think at least for rural Alaska, that will resolve this. It won't in urban, and I want physicians to stay for 48 hours. I don't want them to leave, and that's one of the reasons for the bill. The people come in, it's not that physicians are bad when they come in from Washington. I don't care what state they're from, but I want them to stick around. And we're not even mandating that they be on call and give free services to Alaskans or visitors. But I'm just saying, I want you to have to do surgery. Testimony in Hess was that it's 3 days they come. That's their business. How much they make is their business. Patients going to them is the patient's rights. We're not changing any of that, but that they have to stay for 48 hours after they perform the surgery. Or assigned to another ophthalmologist, which we haven't seen, that's in the city. Is there an objection to that amendment? Hearing none, then amendment number 1 passes as stated. And is there any other amendment to the bill? No. Okay, is there any commentary regarding the bill? Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman,
I had an experience this last year where my wife went to the Pacific Laser Surgery and had excellent service. And the coverage was fortunately through the state, not the not Medicare, because she's a young woman. Get that down, Haley.
We'll have. Want to take it at ease and have gavel? The gavel come down for that one sentence.
Hey, beautiful young woman. Yeah, right now. Nevertheless.
Her choices, sometimes I'm concerned with.
End up with a black eye.
But I must say that one of my major concerns was, I think the surgery, the total cost was in the vicinity of $6,000. But the actual surgery itself lasted, and I witnessed it, they actually had a operatory room with a kind of a guest gallery behind glass that took no more than, I'd say, both eyes, or well, each eye was approximately it was like a minute and a half or 2 minutes. The whole procedure, actually, of the actual surgery itself, lasted only about 5 minutes, where the old lens was surgically removed by a vacuum-like device, and the new lenses were artificial lenses were implanted, and extraordinary professionally done, and. I thought the service was very good, and I believe that the cost of care and the quality of care was there, and the follow-up was done by an optometrist that was on site and a member of the firm. And
And for the record, this firm is the Washington firm. I mean, that has an office in Anchorage.
Right. It's the
just so they understand who what
Pacific Cataract and Laser Institute, right? And so I was very satisfied with that, and I do believe that anything we can do as a legislature to improve the quality of care and lower the costs are a very positive thing. I think there has been some testimony regarding the impacts of that and that affect the quality of care, but I'm not convinced that the incidence of problems that are result from that are not outweighed by the overall quality of care and cost benefits that accrue to them. So I'm very sensitive to the optometrist's arguments, and I've been sitting on this committee for 11 years and seen the eye wars go on almost continually, and so I think this is another chapter in the eye wars. So I'm not particularly supportive of the legislation, Mr. Chairman, and all due respect to your authorship.
Check on who his doctor is. Let him know that. Okay, Representative Blinton, and then Crawford.
Yes, I have to be careful what I say because my optometrist tells me that I may be looking at cataract surgery myself in another year or two. Are you over there? Okay.
Yeah, I'm right here.
I would underline some of the words that my good colleague Representative Rookberg was stating. One of my staffers last year had cataract surgery. I observed the procedure myself, and I was quite amazed. It didn't make me all that anxious to go get it, but I was amazed watching it. But it seemed, you know, obviously eyes are very, very critical. Eye health is critical. Vision is critical. One of the greatest gifts that God has given us. There are very serious issues involved here. But it does appear to me that it seems like the largest issue here may be one of business competition rather than actual post-operative eye care, and I have problems with the bill.
Representative Crawford,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, my occasions to go to an eye doctor over the years haven't been for cataracts. They've been for trauma. And it was good to have a trained ophthalmologist on hand so that I could have my trauma dealt with. It seems to me that it would be in the patient's best interest to have a trained ophthalmologist on hand in case there was something that did go wrong. I think it makes sense that a surgeon, after he performs the surgery, should be here and be available during that critical time. to me, this bill makes perfectly good sense. I want to see us have a trained cadre of ophthalmologists that live here in Alaska and take call and do the things that we need as for the population that lives here. The folks that come up from Washington, I don't want to disparage them. I mean, they probably do really good work. I don't think it's right that they're not here to deal with their problems if they create them or if it just happens. I think that this bill makes good sense, and I support it.
Representative Ledoux?
Well, I want to thank the chairman for putting in that amendment, but I'm still not thrilled with this bill. I just haven't been convinced that there is really a problem here, and my core philosophy is if it ain't broken, don't fix it. But
Representative Guttenberg? So we'll go around the table. You might be surprised, but I find myself in agreement with Representative Crawford and the chair at the same time. I mean, there's some of the arguments here are both economic and relate to patient care. I hate to see the state simply be a place where people come, surgeons, regardless of how good they are, and optometrists who might do good work. But I recently had surgery from somebody that left as soon as they did it, and there were complications. Fortunately, I had a doctor here that was able to cover. And you know, we talk about the lack of specialties in this state, and doctors with specialties who aren't here, and some of those problems. And you know, the economics of this state and what happens with medical coverage along that line. Can side with on that side of the equation for making sure that you know, if there's enough business here to do hundreds of cataracts at a sitting, then you know, the complications resulting, maybe there's surgeons here that would be doing that, and I think they should be here. So I'm going to support the bill.
Well, just in closing, I have editorialized throughout the bill, but I think for the members to understand, I wouldn't have sponsored the bill if I thought it was anti-patient or anti-business. If anything, I think it's just the opposite. I don't degrade or diminish the background education of optometrists, but I think that there's a difference between a surgeon, a medical doctor, and an optometrist. And I would hope anybody would notice and see that difference. And it spells out when it comes to postoperative care that the ophthalmologist has more experience and understanding of problems. And this aspect of call, the monetary amounts, which I think are relative, even though we don't have exact figures on medical malpractice, are all compelling to me. The fact that other states don't have it, I could say that about slavery, women voting. I mean, we can be the first, good for us. You know, meaning 100 years ago, so the first state could have used the same argument. So I never use that one as compelling personally. But it sounds like everyone has testified enough on the bill. We've closed that. We have committee members' responses. So if I could have a motion to move the bill out of committee to the next committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Crawford.
I'd make a motion to move CS for House Bill 151-S. Version F, is that correct? Version F, as amended, and with is a zero this
yeah.
Come out?
Yeah,
I believe.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Objection.
Objection. Okay. Then we'll have a roll call vote. And Representative Cott left me a note. He says he's a yes.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Representative Cott is not here. Representative Guttenberg?
Yes.
Representative Crawford?
Yes.
Representative Roper?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Chairman Anderson?
Yes.
Four yeas, two nays.
Okay, so the bill passes and moves on to
Representative Oakberg's Rules Committee. By the way, you look wonderful today. Thank you for your comment. Okay, so next we will go to the realtor's vote, which I'll postpone. Hang just kidding.
Yeah, postpone, yeah.
As I get slapped. Representative Roepberg, it's his bill, and if he wants to refine, I'm actually going to, I don't know if Feather's going to present it or he is, but he can maybe mark who wants to testify. I realize everybody's tired. If you're itching to testify, I'll testify until we begin operating budget, but otherwise, I assume the bill's going to pass out after your dialogue. If you want to fine-tune your testimony, we'll. I'm sorry to make you wait.
But. Don't say pass out.
Mr. Chairman, there's only three people to testify.
No obligation.
No, I mean,
the likelihood.
No, don't say pass out.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just stay right here very briefly. There's, I think there's three people I want to testify, one from Real Estate Commission and two from the Alaska Board of Realtors. So very briefly, this is a weighty bill, Mr. Chairman, but perhaps before we move on, if we could adopt the committee substitute. Mr. Chairman, I would move.
Make the motion.
I would move that we adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 169, 24LS024424. Excuse me.
Just state the letter.
Yes.
Okay. Is there any objection? Hearing none, version S is before us.
Right, Mr. Chairman. What this committee substitute does is, in the main, adopt the recommendations and a letter from the Alaska Real Estate Commission to make some conforming amendments. And there's a three-page sectional analysis on the committee substitute, which prepared by my hardworking staff, who for a change is here with us today. And this explains the differences. And Mr. Chairman, this is a long bill, but ironically enough, it's 10 pages. There's only two sections that actually have any real substance. That's Section 4. Which increases, or no, excuse me, that creates for the first time 20 hours of post-licensing education within the first year of a person receiving their initial license. In other words, this mandates additional training for new practitioners. And this was done at the request of the Alaska Association of Realtors. This, and the second section is section, well, I have it somewhere, oh yes. I think section 14, Mr. Chairman, it's called use of experts, but this provides that a real estate broker may contract with an attorney or an associate broker to assist the broker in reviewing real estate transactions. Mr. Chairman, there is a statutory requirement that brokers supervise all their activity of their licensees underneath them. This provides the ability for those brokers to retain additional personnel in the form of an attorney. Associate brokers are already allowed under regulation to do this. Those are the only two really substantive changes. There's one other one, Mr. Chairman, that the board recognized. And that is the CS before us, Mr. Chairman. I do have a conceptual amendment on the table.
Okay, before we get to that, Representative Lynn might have a question, then right. We'll adopt your...
I don't have a question, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to declare a conflict of interest. I am a licensed real estate associate broker in the state of Alaska. Some of the party that's down here today, I actually am work as an independent contractor for it, so I want to declare that conflict of interest.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, okay. Ditto on that.
Required to vote? Okay, you'll still be required to vote. And, so why don't you, Representative Gunn?
Just for the rest of us, Representative Crawford or Purdue or myself, at some time might be buying or selling real estate.
Let me give you my card.
Okay.
My card.
That's a $5 fine for advertising at the table.
That's right.
Or soliciting.
Okay. Right. So there's conceptual amendment. I assume you're going to note it as number one. For the record, all the committee members have this. You might want to label it as number one, and he stated as Representative Roepberg, so we know who the sponsor is. Why don't you go ahead and note where the changes are and what they do.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'll just move amendment number one and look for an objection.
Okay, I'll object.
What it does, the first section changes the title where we're getting rid of experts and turning them into review of, or we're changing language to say review of rather than experts. The page 4, line 4, at the request of the Occupational Licensing Director Urien. Oh, Mr. Chairman, I have to do an amendment to the amendment here.
Okay, and I'm going to, can we take a brief at ease? Just super quick, I'm going to ask a question really quick.
I'd like to move an amendment to the amendment on the page 4, line 4, insert, and delete the word renew and substitute reinstate a suspended license.
So deleting renewing and insert reinstate, and that's an amendment to amendment. Is there any objection to that amendment to amendment number 1? Hearing, seeing none, that amendment to amendment number 1 is adopted.
Thank you, Mr.
Now
Chairman.
We have conceptual amendment number 1 before us.
Oh, we also have to do that on the page 4, line 9. Also,
okay.
Reinstating.
Oh, I was...
Right.
I was reading the other. Okay, so yeah, page 4, line 4, the second amendment to amendment number 1 is deleting renew and adding reinstate.
And then on...
seeing no objection, adopted.
On page 5, line 13, want to delete the word 5 and insert 7. This, Mr. Chairman, is at the request of the Real Estate Commission that if there's a revocation for or indictment on the grounds of various rationales for that action, that the associate broker should be consistent with brokers because they're one and the same. So,
and could you restate that? So what's it's page 5, line 13?
No, page 5, line 13, right. Delete 5 and insert 7 years.
Okay.
It's on the amendment.
Yeah. Okay, so it's okay, good.
So question on that, is that conforming to other...
Yeah, it actually conforms to the other portion of the statute, okay. The same as brokers. Brokers have
so
a
what you're referring to isn't the third amendment to the amendment. Now we're discussing
No,
it's amendment
just, I'm sorry. It's just the amendment. Right?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So and we're back to a conceptual amendment. Number 1 is amended with those two reinstatements inserted. So
right,
how about page 8, line
20? Page 8, line 20 is just the header on that section there. It deletes the term as a header, use of experts, and inserts review of transactions.
Okay.
And that is the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objection for discussion purposes? Hearing none, then conceptual. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Guttenberg.
Just to make sure, Mr. Chair, I think you might have been getting ahead of yourself. So I thought you adopted the conceptual amendment before he was done with his changes, so I want to make sure this is the whole amendment before us.
Okay.
Okay.
Right, it's the amendment as amended.
Yeah. And are you sure you want to eliminate brokers for brokers? Just kidding. Okay.
Right.
So I'll remove my objection. If there's no other objection, then conceptual amendment, which it's really not conceptual, it's written out, amendment number 1 is adopted. So we have the bill before us. Is there anyone, and I'm going to allow Representative Roper latitude to call the people, and I'll give you the list because I don't know how
Just
want
go ahead to the top of the order, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We have Dave Feakin. We can call you Dr. Feakin.
Actually, I'm a Borker in Kenai. My name is Dave Feakin. I'm a broker in Kenai, and I'm the industry issues legislative chair for the Alaska Association of Realtors. And very briefly, this bill came primarily from the industry, from not only from associates who are requesting the post-licensing education, but from brokers also that are requesting that type of education when they move from a sales associate to a broker. When they're moving into the ownership of a company or moving into a management type position. We polled our industry within the last 3 years, I believe it was, and 95% of the response was in favor of this type of legislation within the realtor organization. Secondarily, and there are a number of states in the country that have already put this type of post-licensing and education in place. See, you have pre-licensing education to get the license. That pretty much teaches the test. You learn how to pass the exam. The post-licensing education deals with practical applications within the industry. In the states that have put this type of education in place, they've seen a reduction in complaints at their real estate commission level. So it helps, it educates and makes a smarter, more efficient industry. In speaking to the issue of supervision or the review of transactions, that is an issue that came from large brokerage firms requesting the ability to retain an attorney to help them review a files, where they have a very large number of transactions going, and secondarily from firms that do commercial transactions only, very large commercial transactions where generally there are attorneys involved, so you need to have your own attorney to help review those attorneys. That clarifies the issue from a previous piece of legislation that had passed. If there aren't any other questions, that's pretty much, I think this is a pretty clean, self-explanatory bill.
Any questions for Mr. Feakin after his analysis of the legislation, which the Alaska Association of Realtors endorses? Representative Crawford.
Mr. Chairman, over the years, I've bought and sold a number of houses, and I've noticed that some realtors are better than other realtors. Experience seems to have a lot to do with the competence and the job that they do. I think more education is good. If you could give me a little idea about what this 20 hours of education would consist of, and have you thought about maybe doing like a six-month apprenticeship, you know, before you turn these guys loose, you know, where they had some close supervision, because it's a joy to have a good, experienced real estate sales person or professional.
No, I understand your concern, and I believe that is what the point of this is, to address practical, in other words, education regarding the forms that are used within the industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is not taught in a pre-licensing type class, but it would be part of the post-licensing education. the trust accounting and stuff, that's all dealt with in pre-licensing, but primarily it's the practical application of writing offers, presenting them legally, how to draft and craft legally, good solid language, that will be the emphasis of that. The impetus of that will be put upon the Real Estate Commission to create.
Okay.
And I would...
Representative Lynn, did you have a question?
Well, I just want to say, if this passes, which I suspect it will, I'd like to see the emphasis put on the practical real estate rather than just salesmanship.
Right.
And I know that's not your intent, but it's hard. But you know, how do you actually do it, the mechanics of it, rather than how do you get the listing, or how do you make the sale?
And I'm sure that's what's going to happen with it, is that is one of the biggest complaints within the industry, is that, and that new agent that I just had to work with, I had to fill out everything for him. You hear that all the time, and a fair amount of the Real Estate Commission is sitting behind us, so they're here listening to the Alaska Association of Realtors will be involved in that regulation and helping get the type of courses that we're looking for.
And one quick follow-up. It would be possible, like on the first listing appointment, the first writing of a receipt for deposit, that you have somebody there, a mentor with the salesperson who's doing his first transaction. The first listing, the first receipt for deposit, at least. I don't mean to put it in the bill, but I mean just when you write it up.
So noted.
So noted.
Okay, good, good. what we need to do is adopt a zero committee fiscal note, so if there's no objection, that's what the committee will adopt to move forward, because we're still waiting for one from administration. I don't think there is any. Yeah, so far we'll move it on a zero if they can amend that further down the line. So if there's no objection, we'll adopt a zero fiscal note at this stage, on at least the Labor and Commerce viewpoint.
For the record, we support all of the amendments that have been put forward.
Okay. Oh, that's awesome. Oh, okay.
Are we ready to move
the bill? Okay. We won't move the bill yet. We'll have, okay. Go ahead.
I'll be very quick. I'm Peggy M. McConaughey. Yep. I'm also with the Alaska Association of Realtors, a member of the Key Issues Industry Work Group, and I am actually the education chair of a subcommittee of the Real Estate Commission. We're the ones who originally came up with this idea, and we thought we were real bright and nobody else did it, and then found out that more than 18 states in the United States already did it. So we went, well, we're just behind the times. But I thank you for your support and listening to this bill. We are very excited as an industry that our industry wants it, because it is going to be consumer protection, so we don't have to run into those people who the brokers just shoved in their cars and said, go out and sell something. And we're looking forward to increasing the professionalism of our profession. Thank you very much.
We appreciate it, and we really appreciate you all waiting today. I know it's frustrating when there's other bills in advance. Judiciary was 3 hours, same thing. Anyone else want to testify, or just super quick name for the record, endorse, since you've been waiting?
Yeah, there's a... Yeah. Right.
Okay. Oh, I thought you said that
third,
was it.
The third.
Okay. Okay. Jerry?
No, my name is Brad Flitch.
That's right. Well, you came before our committee last year. I'm sorry.
And then I'll call you online here.
Yeah, Jerry, we'll get to you after Brad here.
I am the public member on the Real Estate Commission.
That's right.
And we support the bill. We support the committee substitute as amended. It includes all of the board's discussions and technical amendments we made. So we're in full support.
Good. I think I remember you came before our committee when you were confirmed by the legislature. Nice to see you again, Brad. Thank you. And then last, Jerry Royce, Royce and Associates. Jerry, if you could be brief, it sounds like you endorsed the bill, but go ahead and state your name for the record and any quick comments.
Sure. It's my name's Jerry Royce, and I'm a real estate broker here in Anchorage. I absolutely support the bill. I think it's a great idea. There were a couple of issues in Representative Roekberg's special analysis that I thought I would point out, and that is in Section 11, the statement was that it requires real estate licensee to complete the post-education requirements before an Alaska license will be issued. If you look at Section 26-3, it says that they have up to 1 year to complete that. So it's not accurate from the perspective of what the bill actually says. It just probably needs to be looked at. These are more corrections or inconsistencies that I saw that I thought should be brought out. Another one was Section 14, and in Section 14, where the use of experts is allowed, that the in some cases you might have a smaller brokerage that may need to use someone to do that review, where it says that that an attorney or associate broker can be paid to assist. That if it said attorney, broker, associate broker through their employing broker. The reason I state that is because this law, in terms of 403, says that if I'm a broker, I could technically pay an associate broker from another firm directly based on this language, and that's inconsistent with the requirement that all payments made be to a licensee be paid through their employing broker, and I think that. If that were clarified by including that, an associate broker through their employing broker. I mean, if it's an in-house associate broker, then that's not an issue. But if I'm a small broker, doesn't have an associate broker, I have to rely on somebody to do that. I wouldn't want there to be an inconsistency in state law relative to having a broker from a different firm paying an associate broker directly. It should go through the associate broker's broker. So that was just a couple of things that I saw that were inconsistent with other areas of the statute. I've talked to some folks about, and this is very well supported, as the earlier folks have mentioned, the definition of when the first license is issued, I think, is a little unclear, because it appears, by the way, under Section 12, or rather I should say under Section 16, under 990.12a, where we go into a definition of what first means, it appears to me that there's a it would require that a person who was moving from a broker to associate broker status or in the other direction could potentially it could be interpreted to mean that every time they change their status, it may be necessary to go back through that 20-hour program. The under 95, it says that if the broker had been an associate broker prior to, then they would not need this. I'm just curious that, initial post-licensing training is one thing, but it appears that by this language that as a person moves from licensee to associate broker, they would need to have it again, and then if they move from associate broker to broker or back, it might be possible that it could be interpreted that they would need it again. And I'm just, you know, it's a little unclear to me. I think post-licensing is great. I don't know that, you know, additional post-licensing training for an associate broker or broker is necessary. If there's more training needed, then we ought to increase the broker upgrade training instead.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Royce. Peggy, you want to respond to that?
State your name.
In the first instance, under Section 14, I'd say the use of experts, Mr. Royce's interpretation is incorrect in as much as the associate broker already has to be registered or be in the employ of the broker. So an associate broker can't work for two brokers at one time.
I'm clear, but it says that we could pay an associate broker. It doesn't say that the associate broker has to be underneath our particular license. If I'm a broker, this doesn't say one of my associate brokers. It just says that we can bring in an associate broker. That could be, you know, construed to mean that I could bring in an associate broker from another firm to review those.
Well, Jerry, let the record reflect you can't.
Okay.
Because that's the way the statute is. You have to be employed by a broker.
I'm clear, but does what this says is that if an associate broker is working for you and you're a broker, and then I could hire him to review my transactions and
pay
him directly.
No, you can't because you're listed.
Okay, well, Jerry, let Representative Burford maybe respond. We understand your concern, so go ahead without a dialogue.
You can only work for one broker at a time. I mean, that's the way the law is drafted, and it's, I think that's very clear. So.
Okay,
I can see his point if you read it independently, the sentence, but you have to look at the whole chapter to make it okay, make
and
sense.
And then further, state your name for the
yeah,
record.
Peggy M. McConaughey, once again, with the Alaska Association of Realtors. And just real quickly, Jerry, you're dealing with an older version of the bill. We made some changes in the bill in order to be able to better clarify that once you took as an associate broker the post-licensing education, when you move from associate broker to broker, you do not have to take the post-licensing again. So we made that just more clear, and I think the bill stands fine as it
is. Is there any question from the committee on that issue?
Well, on that point, I find myself agreeing with the representative from Sand Lake the second time this hearing.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Royce, for testifying. I see no one else on the roster to testify, so I'll close the public hearing portion of the bill. Is there any comments before I ask for a motion to move the bill out? Seeing, hearing none, then I'll ask Representative Lynn to note that there's a zero labor and commerce fiscal note.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's my pleasure to move CS for House Bill 169, 24-LS0424/S
zero labor and commerce fiscal note.
Zero labor and commerce fiscal note.
An individual
recommendation.
Any objections? Seeing, hearing none, so moved. And I just want to thank the committee for staying late today. We're going to adjourn at 6 p.m., and it was very kind of you to stay and help with these two bills. So we adjourn at 6 p.m.
Hey, Mr.